Hello, it's Shahid, and welcome back to another Creative Floor Awards podcast. You are officially, somehow, listening to the world's number one marketing podcast, according to the Podomatic Global Charts. Thank you to everyone who listens, subscribes, shares all of these episodes around, and also for the very kind personal messages you've been sending me on this season's episodes. Final call deadline for this year's awards is this Friday, the 26th of April. No more excuses, unfortunately, no more extensions. The very best of luck to everyone entering this year. All your support allows us to do all our Talent Diversity Fund work. And of course, these podcasts, which I guess is why you're still here listening to me. So we have a really brilliant episode for you today. We speak to Susan Manba, who's the Chief Patient Officer at Publicis Health. I believe she's the only Chief Patient Officer within the sort of advertising communication space. So even if you just want to find out what that role entails and what it means, it's worth just sticking around for that, really. Susan shares a very heartfelt and incredible story about her journey into the industry, an encounter with Steve Jobs, also getting diagnosed with a super rare form of cancer as a single mother, the impact that has on someone working in the healthcare communication space. There's a really wonderful bit in the conversation where Susan talks about the impact on her role that it has on her identity. There's so much stuff in here, and I don't want to spoil too much, but it's an incredible story. And as an added bonus, if you're currently sat in your agency and you think that your creative briefs are a little bit average, kind of seen it all before, there are some fantastic hacks in here for you and your teams to take your briefs to the next level. So do yourself a favor, try and listen to this in one go in a quiet space. I can't wait for you to hear this one. Enjoy. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning, Shahid. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Susan, thank you for joining us. You know, one of the great things about doing these podcasts, selfishly for me, is I get the privilege to get behind people's stories, you know, learning from their best lessons, how they overcame adversity, where they got to where they are today. And I know a little bit about your journey. And I just thought if I could get your story out into the ears of at least one person out there who needs a little bit of inspiration, then I think that's a really cool thing to do. So is that okay?
That's absolutely okay. And I really think it's a fabulous project. I'm very happy to participate. And you've already got my juices flowing and going back in time a bit. You know, it's funny. I recently had to update my CV, and I always start with how I grew up. That I grew up asking why. Not in an obnoxious way, but because my parents really, really encouraged deep thinking and research. My dad was a science writer. My mom ran the reference section at the U.S. mission to the UN. So I quite literally grew up having conversations and within a world that was, and I have a twin brother, and they always said, you can be whatever you want to be. And so I went to school absolutely convinced I would be a journalist. I came from a family of journalists. I loved the whole investigative process. And then this whole new world of cognitive and behavioral science was starting in the early 80s. Frankly, I don't think I even realized just how new the field was that had started in the 70s, as, you know, Tanneman and Kaversky and all of these researchers were finding different ways to think about how do you really impact behavior and how do you engage people. So it took me a detour. If you had ever told me that I would work for a multinational, you know, communications company, I would have told you you were crazy. I thought I was going to, you know, be a journalist or do, you know, not-for-profit work, because it was for me all about how do you have real impact. You know, as a kid, I got to listen to my dad interviewing doctors about the greatest advances in medicine. And so somehow, you know, when I went to Vassar, and I was actually one of the very first people to start digging into this notion even of multidisciplinary work. And so my early career was really global market research. And after a few years, though, I kept saying, but where does it go? I kept always wanting to look for how do we really make an impact? And so people said, well, you know what? You can go client side or you can go agency side. And I will tell you, it was a gift. I ended up at a jewel of a small agency called Amorati and Puris. And they're famously the ultimate driving machine folks. But I remember going there because the remarkable creative directors, Martin Puris and Ralph Amorati, they said, you know what? When we were at our last place, we ran roughshod over everyone because, you know, creative was it. But we don't want that kind of agency. We want an agency that has the best and brightest in every discipline. And I will never forget this. Martin said to me in my interview that 80% of advertising fails before pen is ever put to paper because it isn't based on a solid foundational brief. And you know, he would quote, you know, David Ogilvy, give me the freedom of a tight brief. So it was the early, early days of account planning, so much so that my first title was like associate research director. And the notion that so much of what was going on in the States was very evaluative. Like, okay, we're going to do an advertisement and we're going to evaluate it. Whereas in Europe, the early days, it was much more about the story. So I kind of became global girl, going around the world, finding who were the real strategic account people who could come back to the States, be trained up, and go back to their home countries. So it was really a gift in my early career that I got to travel the world. And, you know, for me, it's so funny now as I've just had a milestone birthday and turned 60. In fact, I've been saying 60 is the new 60. You heard it here. But I was like the wonder kid. I was the youngest planning director in New York. And my issues at the time, I remember when I was pregnant with my first son, because I gave birth to my son and my first planning department in the same year. And I was petrified. I was like, can I be a good mom and be a good planning director? How do I balance out the 24/7 world that is advertising with, you know, being a good mom? So I called up all the planning directors who were moms, and they were amazing. In fact, one came and met me and gave me her good quality maternity clothes because she was like, ah, the maternity clothes are awful. You need something nice to wear when you're presenting. And so truly the notion of a planning community was just being born as I was coming up in the world. And my early years, I've always liked the complicated, Shahid. You know, I always said, like, even though I, you know, I did my fair share of CPG, in the early days of Amorati, it truly was, you know, high-end luxury goods and newest technologies. You know, I got to work with Steve Jobs when he had left Apple to go to Next and start Next Computer. I had the first Next Computer, which was the most beautiful piece of technology I've ever had.
What was he like?
He was everything they say in that he was very clear. And funny, for a researcher, he very famously was like, I don't need no stinking research. Nobody could tell me they needed a graphical user interface. And yet, it's funny, if you ever see the movie, there's a scene where they hold up the big spread of the launch ad that I worked on. And I was like, oh my God, to have been there at those early, early days. And in fact, Ken Siegel, who was the creative director, you know, who ended up being the, you know, the 1984 guy and went out to Giant Day. So, and ended up working with him and Apple forever and ever, ever. So to me, that's where having been a kid at those early days. And then of course, you know, it's funny. I don't even remember what inspired me to do this. At the time there was the, you know, how you should do a resume to stand out. Because remember, you had to actually pick nice paper that had a good weave. Because, you know, how are you going to stand out from the stack of things? And so someone had said, you know, put your key beliefs on your resume. And I was like, huh, that's a really interesting assignment. Let me have a think. And these are still to this day, 30 some odd years later, three things. Question everything. Not in an asshole way, but because it's the way we did it before. Doesn't mean the way we should do it now. Second, diverse minds attacking a problem from different angles always yields a better result. And remember, this was the 80s. We weren't talking about diversity at the time. But to me, I think I never wanted to be the smartest person in the room. I always wanted to be challenged by different perspectives. And I thought that's how I would learn best. And so third was that relationships are the key to selling breakthrough ideas. They can happen in the room the day you meet someone. But because I was such a kid, you know, I was walking into boardrooms where people were twice my age. How was I? God, why were they going to listen to me, you know? And so to me, that notion of really deeply listening, and a great piece of advice I got early on from a boss was, you know what, kid, you got a lot of things to say. Out of every two things you want to say, say the one you really think that counts. We were incredibly fortunate. Michelle Obama came and addressed us at the beginning of the pandemic. And she said, you know what, guys, you marketers in the health space, we need you more than ever as we address all these issues, as we address, you know, vaccine hesitancy and all these issues, because marketing skills are truly the skills that are going to change the world. And I never forgot that. The very first creative directors I worked with here said something great. He was like, you know what, Sue? If you give me a box, I'm going to be creative in that box. You make that box smaller, I'm going to be creative. The smaller you make it, the more creative I'm going to be. And so I think now, whoever would have thought when I was learning the early principles of like machines that think 35 years ago, the year that we've had, that, you know, you couldn't go anywhere and not think about Gen AI and what it's going to mean. But I come from a place that's like, okay, first and foremost, if you want to impact people's health and well-being, you have to start with trust. And I don't know if you're familiar with Rachel Botsman's work on trust at Oxford. She's really an interesting researcher. But, you know, her theory basically comes from once upon a time, not that long ago, we did trust our, you know, institutions, our governments, our church. But over time, it's really dissipated now, so that it went from, you know, that to local, to truly distributed trust. So now, in a world where people might be more likely to see a TikTok video than our comms, that driving people to a site, all the things that we used to think about in the early days of digital, it's a whole new world now.
Thank you to the sponsor of this podcast, Boom CGI. They're a team of digital artists specializing in the craft of CGI animation across entertainment, advertising, and of course, pharma. The team love nothing more than taking ideas from concept through to completion. They are highly skilled in delivering character design, CGI modeling, texturing, animation, and post-production, and are huge, huge supporters of the Creative Floor Awards. So do check them out at boomcgi.com.
The wall is getting ready. Is that player doing a self-exam? Look at that switch from left to right. No lumps, no changes in shape or size. The ball's too cancer nil. Visit testicularcancersociety.org to keep your team on top form.
It's now, gosh, 11 years ago. It was right after Hurricane Sandy, and we had been out of power. My then 13-year-old daughter, Serena, and I had been volunteering down in the Rockaways, but we came back to the house to check on the animals, and the lights came back on. And, you know, we're horsing around. Yay, we're past this. And her head ended up in my lap, and she looked up at me and said, "Hey, Mom, what's that on your nose?" And I looked up, because, you know, you don't usually look under your nose when you're getting up in the morning. I was like, huh, that is a really weird place for a pimple on the rim of my nostril. Truly, she saved my life. Because I made an appointment with my derm, who also thought nothing of this tiny nothing lesion. She said, "Oh, you know what? Now, this is now Christmas time in New York, and we're getting ready to go away." She's like, "You know, I can't do this in the office. It's a vascular lesion." And she sent me off to the Laser Skin and Surgery Center. I'll never forget. The doctor's name was Leonard Bernstein. How can you forget that? Right? And he, too, was like, "Oh, it's nothing. Even if it's a basal cell, it's tiny. We've got this. Have a good time. Here's some sunscreen. Go off on holiday." And I took my daughter away on a little mother-daughter Christmas kayaking trip in Puerto Rico. Got back, and it was New Year's Eve. And I was getting ready for my date and, you know, little sparkly dress. What should I wear? And I thought, you know, that's weird. They never called me. So I put in a call to the doctor's office. And literally on 2 o'clock on the dot on New Year's Eve, the doctor calls and said, "Are you sitting down?" So he had no conversation in the history of the world that was good was ever. And what he said was, "You have a rare, aggressive, and usually deadly form of skin cancer called Merkel cell carcinoma. You're going to need major treatment. You're going to need major reconstructive surgery. Basically, get thee to a surgeon right away. So you can imagine, my daughter had picked up the extension upstairs. We still had those things, you know, back then. She comes running downstairs and she's like, cancer, what, who, what? And she takes one look at me. So she cries, I cried. But I'll tell you, that was the last time I cried until the day I had a clean PET scan. Because I was, all the research I was doing, and this was the ultimate irony. I had just spent a year launching a bunch of drugs in the cancer space. I had just been the caregiver to both my mother and ultimately my dad. I thought I knew a little something about this, but what I started learning immediately was you can know a lot from research and interviews and being a caregiver, but when you're going through it yourself, it's just fundamentally different.
Were you surprised that you didn't cry?
You know, I had read so much that a positive outlook and being truly the core of your care team was the difference between survival and not. So I was, and you know what? I was a single mom. Everything was resting on my shoulders. So my perspective from day one was carpet bomb me. I want to live. For me, the cancer was never the thing that impacted my health. The treatment and all of the side effects now. So for me, the next time I sobbed like a baby was the day I got a clean PET, because it meant that I was really able to think about having a life going forward. Everything in that. And the other thing that was interesting, Shahid, about my, I had the fastest journey ever. I mean, I work with people all the time who it's years and years. Going back to New Year's Eve. So I called Sloan. And it wasn't until years later that I found out why they said, we'll get back to you. And I'm like, I'm sorry, what didn't you understand about rare, aggressive, and deadly? And they were like, well, we'll get back to you. And so at 4 o'clock on New Year's Eve, I called my mom's oncologist. I had lost my mom in June to stage 4 adenocarcinoma. In earlier in the year, I had launched a big campaign. We called it United We Test, because it was about, people didn't understand back then. You know, remember, those were the days when cancer treatment equaled chemo, radiation, and surgery. That was what it was. The idea of these new agents that were targeted, the idea that biomarker testing and genetic testing was meaningful was like so brand new. And so I had been the one who had to convince my family, no, it's okay. We can wait to start treatment for a little while and see. Unfortunately, in mom's case, she didn't have any genetic underpinnings. We took her home. We made her comfortable. And for those 5 months of hospice care, I've never been more grateful. My mom grew up in France and in Paris. And toward the end, she sort of was reverting back to her language. And we got her a lovely nurse from Haiti who could speak with her. She mostly spoke with me. And, you know, in those days, it was just a few blocks away from the Digitas offices. And I could run over and give her a few spoonfuls of soup, hold her hand, read a book, whatever it would be. And so I knew what, you know, that kind of end stage would be. And, you know, the thing about my mom was my mom spoke 7 languages. She was a force of nature. And I think, honestly, it would have killed her to watch me go through treatment in this way. So I had just come through all of that. And you know, I don't always share. In fact, the fact that you remembered this and I've shared, I had gone through, you know, a really, really challenging divorce. Very sadly, my ex-husband was at the Trade Center on 9/11, and I'm one of those stories you don't hear. He got out in body, but not in spirit, and really wasn't able to be a husband or father anymore. And so I very much was on my own, which was what drove me to say, no, I am, you know, no matter what it takes, I will do anything that it takes to, you know, stay on. And so that New Year's Eve, I called my mom's oncologist, Abraham Chichua. He runs MedOnc at NYU Langone, and he told me, okay, Mark Persky at Beth Israel. And I said, I'm sorry, I don't think of that as the hotbed of cancer care in New York. And he's like, no, he was our head of head and neck for 25 years. He knows more about Merkel cell than anyone else on the East Coast. Oh, go to him. And so this is where, you know, people often say, it is not just what you know, it's who you know. So I was in his office on January 2nd. And I will never forget this. He said, all right, I'm going to confirm this pathology. And if it's Merkel cell, I'm bumping everybody but the babies for you. He did. And it was. So I then had 2 weeks to figure out and wrap up everything that I was doing. Occasionally, I do remind our CEO that I hired 3 people to do my job while I was out. then I said, because that was the hardest thing. What do you mean I can't work? They're like, no. Not only can't you work, you can't go home. I'm like, I'm sorry, I'm a single mother. What do you mean I can't go home? They were like, no, you're going to have no immune system. Like, to save your life, you're going to have no immune system. So I was able to stay at this remarkable place that's run by the American Cancer Society called Hope Lodge. And they run these for people who, you know, it's funny, I live in the Hudson Valley. All these years I used to say I live in my country house but spend no time here. Well, that's not true anymore. But at the time, I was a good hour and a half away from the hospital. And so I ended up staying at Hope Lodge, which I had thought was going to be a fairly Spartan affair. And it was like checking into the West End. It was amazing. It was very much a holistic experience. And this also changed my trajectory in, as much as I believe fundamentally in the powers of Western medicine and the advances, that the holistic and Eastern care that I got to manage side effects and to take care of who I was as a human, absolutely, I tell everyone, to avail themselves. If it was Qigong, Jujin Jitsu, acupuncture, buds on my ears, you know, because, you know, not that anybody likes throwing up, but I really hate throwing up. So surrounding myself, I took Jon Kabat-Zinn's mindful meditation class. I went into yoga. I started knitting. It was like anything that I could do to take my mind off what was pretty much 24/7 pain. And, you know, now with the terrible, terrible world of, you know, the fentanyl crisis and everything else, I remember, you know, some of my worst days. And actually, I realized I fibbed. This was the one other day during treatment that I was just a little teary because I was told you need a fentanyl patch. I went to 6 different pharmacies and they were like, sorry, we're out. So by the time I got to my amazing plastic surgeon's office to take my stitches out, he took one look at me and he's like, what? And, you know, the tears fell and I'm like, I'm the one who's supposed to get this fentanyl patch and I can't find it anywhere and I'm not everywhere. And God bless him, he said, sit there, hold on. And he called over to his buddy who ran pharmacy at Sloan and he took out my stitches and he patched me up and he walked me outside and he put me in a cab to Sloan and they were waiting there with some fentanyl patches for me. That's a kind, kind doctor. And so that's also part of my journey. I've gotten to the point now, I mean, I spend a lot of time interviewing doctors and nurses around the world. I can tell you in 5 minutes whether this is a clinician who I want to engage with, who I would recommend to family. But it also sent me down the path that I've been on now, which is, you know, we're at a fascinating moment in cancer care. And think about it, like 1/3 of the launches this year are going to be oncology. When we think about where we're finally going from body part cancer to the underpinnings of what causes this terrible disease. And I'm sure, you know, you've probably seen the initiative that we've been doing that we launched called Working with Cancer. And this is something that I'm really incredibly proud of. Arturo Sadoun, who's our CEO, you know, famously was diagnosed with a head and neck cancer. And many people, and I think I played a part in it, reached out to him and said, you know, part of this journey is really hard. We're all hard charging, you know, round the clock working people. And, you know, and our identities are very much caught up with our work identities. I mean, you don't work in this space. You know, we spend most of our lives with our colleagues, right? Even more than our families. And so I helped to support the team and I did a lot of the foundational research on, so what is the impact on your work identity? How do you feel? Are you afraid to tell your employer? And one of the most powerful questions was that people were more afraid to tell their employer in many cases than their families. Because how would it impact your livelihood? How will it be seen if you do need to say? And this is now something we've launched a Healing Spaces program. And I was lucky enough to be part of the first tranche of people who went through it. And this is truly now, this has been life-changing. And so I got this coach, and I don't know if you ever heard of the Enneagram.
No.
I had not done it before. And so it's a exercise that lets you understand like what really fundamentally motivates you as a human. It's a really great exercise. I think everybody should do it. Well, I turned out to be a 2, which is like the considerate helper. That was a big unlock for me. I'm like, oh, what drives all my pleasing behaviors? And but they finally asked me, because still in the middle of being hospitalized, I was still trying to do a pitch. And they were like, what will it take for you to say no? Yeah. And I was like, I can't say no. And they said, why do you think you don't deserve to say no? And it stopped me cold. And I was like, wow, no one has ever asked me that question. I don't think I've, it was like, I'm a senior executive. This needs to be done. So of course I'm going to do it. And I'm going to pile one more thing in. And so it's really driven a lot of change for me. And I don't like to think about, you know, quote, New Year's resolutions.
Mm-hmm.
But I have realized for myself that a lot of these great practices that I had picked up when I was in active treatment fell along the wayside when I came back to work.
Yeah.
In fact, I mean, and this is so nuts. Like I you're going to be like, what? Come on. This isn't real. When I first started traveling again and flying, my neck would swell up. The first time it happened, I was in the middle of a pitch and they're like, Sue, you don't look so good. Like go. It was only about a month after I came back, and I go to the bathroom and I'm like red faced and it's slowly swelling across my face. So I called the oncologist. He's like, go to the ER now. Well, I ended up in the ICU for a week. And they couldn't, they thought this is some weird infection. They couldn't figure out what was going on. Finally, at my wit's end, I'm like, you smart doctors, can you please figure this out? I texted pictures of myself to the radiation oncologist. Dr. Lou Harrison had gone down to Moffitt by this point. And God bless him, he called me 5 minutes later. And he says, look, I have a photographic memory. I remember every radiation plan I ever did. I can tell you what this is. It's called radiation recall. It only happens to 0.5% of people who go through radiation and chemo at the same time. Most people don't do that. It's a lot. Back to my carpet bomb me to live, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out this is a rare syndrome, but he said, get me the head of infectious disease. Get her off the antibiotics. Get her on steroids and antihistamines. And I was out of the ICU in 6 hours. And I tell this story because that's what advocacy is. And I tell every patient I work with that, you know what? You're not a doctor, but you're the expert in you and your body.
Yeah.
And this notion really fuels almost all of the health equity work that we're doing and what I'm calling the Health Visibility Project. Because now all that data that I was telling you about that we can use for marketing purposes, now we're using it for what I'm calling the 3 C's of equity-centered design. And by that, I mean clinical, commercial, and community are the 3 C's. Because we talk about this, right? Why don't more people participate in clinical trials? Why is there such, you know, misrepresentation and underrepresentation? Well, fewer than 5% of people are ever asked. So let's start by asking. I had a wonderful, it's an anecdote. I don't have the data behind it, but I had a wonderful story from a radiation oncologist here in New York. And they said, you know, we had a site in Brooklyn and we should have been able to be recruiting, you know, a diverse population, but we weren't. In fact, it was under 2%. So we were like, what the heck is going on? And we finally said, all right, you know what? What if we just make it a protocol that it is absolutely everybody's responsibility to make sure that everyone who walks in these doors is offered clinical trial information and that no one is assumed, oh, you have Medicaid. Oh, you don't speak English as a first language. No one is assumed to not be able to participate. 2 years later, 60%. So I, again, admittedly, it's not like I can say that's been around the country, but these are the small, really meaningful insights. And that's why I go to back to clinical. Okay. So now we were working with a client and they said, you know, we're having a really tough time recruiting this Asian population. And I said, well, which one? And they're like, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, Chinese, Japanese,
yeah, Asian? And they're like, oh, South Asian. Okay, great.
So in our data, we in fact did find over 50 patients who met the inclusion-exclusion criteria for their trial. But guess what, Shahid? Not a one of them lived within 6 hours of a site.
But we dug in deeper and we found, oh, but look, 20 of them are seeing the same clinician of South Asian descent at this regional health system. Has anyone considered talking to them about being a PI? No, of course, right? So again, that's not what we set out to do. But the idea now is, and it's really meaningful when we come to rare disease. And, you know, I think it's 3 days. Yeah, Monday is Rare Disease Day. And now I come back to being a rare disease survivor. We, you know, these are such tiny groups. In fact, in the beginning, I was like, wait, why are all these big companies spending so much money on indications for my weird, rare Merkel cell carcinoma? The fact that both Keytruda and Bavencio, which I'm working on, are indicated for migraine, what's up? And it's because everyone has Merkel cells. And they think that by studying this rare skin cancer, we're going to learn more about all kinds of cancer. So that's why it's being studied. But through that work, I was like, you know, we talk about rare all the time, but if you put all the rare people together, it's 10% of the population. But less than 10% of these diseases have any treatments at all.
While you were going through your treatment, I'm sorry if this is a really stupid question, but it's just sort of popped into my head. Do you think the comms let you down through your treatment, or do you think it aided your treatment?
That's a great question. The truth of the matter is there were almost no comms. I hate to say it, but there's only 12,000 derms in America. And you can wait up to 3 months for an appointment. In Europe, it can be even further. And so, you know, if you're really stuck, like I've told people, guys, I hate to say it, if they're telling you 3 months, call them back and say, hi, I'm interested in Botox. They'll see you next week. And then you can say, by the way, look at this. And I hate to say it, but that has saved a few lives because it's a terrible thing. But like, I'm sorry, this is a reality, right? That like there are a lot of practices where you have derms who have split up, those who are doing the, you know, Mohs surgeries and skin checks and the rest. I mean, it's a huge cultural shift. The foundation was started in 1974 by Dr. Perry Robbins, who invented Mohs surgery. And that's the approach, the idea that instead of just doing a biopsy and coming back in time, that you literally, they check and they check and they check to make sure that you're clear. And that has absolutely, changed the game in terms of this world. But again, it's like, I think we're at a really interesting moment as, again, in the same way that we didn't think we'd be talking about Gen AI, whoever would have thought that doctors making TikToks about hair would be the way, I mean, I have 4 kids, they go from 21 to 27. And I tell you now, that's where they're getting their health information.
What I'm finding really interesting here is you started out your story right at the beginning about, you know, you're really interested in journalism. And I think that's, you know, the desire to find the truth. It's almost like your journey through, you know, your cancer has almost taken you from the desire to finding the truth to you are the truth, because you have that perspective now. And I guess I'm just sort of connecting some dots of like how that would naturally lead to you being the chief patient officer. How did that actually come about? It makes sense in hindsight, but I'd just like to find out a little bit more.
Absolutely. I love the question, and it is an interesting story, I think, anyway. First, the question was, did I want to step up and be chief strategy officer of PubHealth, come out of DH? And I actually said no, because the way I had structured the role at Digitas, I had ultimately built up brand strategy, engagement strategy, and data strategy. But we had a chief data officer and we had a content officer. And so I said, I think we're going to confuse people and run into each other. There's got to be a different way to craft this. But I give all credit to Alex Pomplato, who came back to me 2 weeks later and said, how about we create a chief patient officer? Like, we're seeing CMOs be appointed in pharma. Most people are like, well, what do you mean? Didn't they always have them? I'm like, nope.
This is new. I mean, think about it. Gail Horwood at Novartis was our very first one. And now, you know, we've seen Erica Taylor at Genentech, and we see, Drew at Pfizer. Like, we've seen this movement to the notion that we do need to elevate the marketing discipline in life sciences. So I think that's part of why I've been able to get traction in these senior leadership teams, because everyone's talking about we need to get patient-centric. They're in wildly different places. Actually, ironically, through the pandemic, I sort of was the one who got sent out to all the non-health and health adjacent brands, because it was like, all right, kids, like it or not, we are all now health marketers. If you want someone to come back to your dealership or walk into your McDonald's, like, we need to deal with how will people feel safe and comfortable coming back. So that notion of being a subject matter expert in health, because, you know, the stuff we rattle off and understand on the regulations and tools, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, I mean, you know this as well as everyone, that we always had this, that pharma, that's like icky stuff, or I don't want to do that, or all the regulations, it makes it, terrible. And we've said forever, like, there will be no beaches, there will be no bicycles, there will be no, gray hairs, that, we're going to tell real meaningful stories and reflect humanity. And so that's my job. That's my job is, I say it's, when I introduce myself, sometimes I say it's as simple and as complicated as making sure that we're really putting the patient at the heart of everything that we're doing.
How much better do you think your briefs have got since you've come out of your treatment?
That's a really good question. I'm going to say a couple of things. I think the first thing that we did was we said, if we're really going to have inclusive briefs, we need to build that into the briefs from moment one. It's not an afterthought. So I think if there was anything that we did that really changed the way we briefed, that we said, if we're really going to be equity center designers, we need to be thinking about inclusivity at the start, not the end. So I would say that may have been the big, because just having the team think about that every time we do a brief, no matter what. We weren't. It was, and breaking down the silos, I think, between what had been general market and multicultural is the other thing that I think has affected our briefs in a really positive way. This is where the cases come in, right? Everyone wants something innovative, and then they want to see how did you do it three times, right? I mean, that's the reality. So to me, when we can work with clients who are like-minded and really want to demonstrate impact, and that's the unlock, really, at the end of the day, is, I came back from my sabbatical 4 years ago with a clear intention coming into this new role that my purpose is to use communications to save lives.
One last question then. At 60, what would you say to your younger self, if you could? What would you go back and say?
I would say use your no's to protect your yeses.
Fantastic, Susan. Well, look, thank you from the bottom of my heart for sharing your journey. You've given us some incredible gems of how to get smarter work, how to get the better briefs. I think every agency should be looking at getting their own chief patient officer. And I loved everything you said about questioning everything, the power of diverse minds, building relationships. And I really appreciated putting the user at the center of your process, the beginning, the middle, and the end. And I guess that kind of ties it back to how maybe Steve Jobs would have done things back in the day.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Shahid. Have a great rest of your day.